thank you for coming. My name is Ben Rogers, and I'm director of Centre for London. For those of you who don't know me, a few unfamiliar faces in the audience and a few familiar ones. We're going to change the order the speakers are speaking in. Tony's got to leave to give evidence to a select committee on devolution and city economy, is a subject which he knows quite a bit about. So he's going to go first, then we'll go to Max, and finally we'll go to Sarah. I'm proud to say that both Tony and Max are Centre for London associates. I gather they've got some association with this place as well. Right, okay. Tony, so what we'll do is one final point. Tony's going to speak and we'll ask him to take questions for Tony. Then I'll invite the other two speakers to do their bit. And then we'll have a plenary session after that. So we'll take questions to Max and Sarah along with questions to other plenary speakers. Right.
Okay, thank you, Ben, and I'm sorry to have caused order to be shuffled around somewhat, and I'm going to continue a tradition already established this afternoon of using a series of slides, many of which have enough information or on a slide or a table to accommodate an entire afternoon's discussion. So I'm going to whiz through these, and bear with me. Now, first, I'm going to talk about, as the title says, sorry, I can't go backwards, as we've discovered previous. Right, migration and politics, but particularly trying to look at the impact on voting in London in the period now, 50-year period, in which there has been a substantial amount of migration. So the migration that I'm going to talk about is a mixture of what you might call earlier migration, 40s, 50s and 60s, and the radical uptick in migration that occurred in the mid-1990s onwards, which is obviously of a very different kind. We've heard echoes of this already this afternoon. So what I've done here is to look, and these figures will become important again later, at what would have been seen as the migrant population, the new Commonwealth immigrants, as they were then called. And I realise I'm battening together here two rather different concepts, but bear with me. So what would have been seen as the new Commonwealth immigrant population, which wasn't quite the same as the non-white British population. After all, for example, it didn't have Irish migrants in it, but this is taken from earlier censuses. And this is just the build-up in that population over time. These are figures not dissimilar to ones we've seen earlier this afternoon. And of course, just to unravel that a bit, in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, migration from the new Commonwealth, which is seen as broadly synonymous with what was then called an ethnic minority status, these terms change, largely from the Caribbean, India and Pakistan. By the 90s, of course, many earlier migrants had families who were born in the UK. Earlier statistics we've seen this afternoon, I think, hint at that. And then, of course, from later in the 1990s, we've seen a new wave of immigration, including people from Europe, North America, Latin America, and who are now, along with many of these earlier migrants, defined as non-white British, a much wider concept, including, as it does, as I would say, everybody from American bankers to the third generation children of people who arrived from the Empire Windrush. So an interesting combination, but worth bearing that in mind. So, in my view, non-white British is an only partly helpful measure for the reasons I've just hinted. Now, in my view, minority ethnic status and migration can't be segregated when we're trying to assess voting effects or political effects of migration. And that's partly because most of the studies that are done about the impacts on voting of migration are not about migration, they're about minority ethnic status, so the way minority ethnic people behave. And of course, that's a group which includes earlier migrants, many of whom, of course, are now relatively elderly, their children and grandchildren, arguably, certainly within minority ethnic status, but new immigrants who are within the non-white British group, many of whom are rich, some of whom are poor, vice versa, a mixture of both. These are all relevant to a study, or certainly the studies of electoral behaviour that are undertaken conventionally. So if we look at figures taken from the 2010 general election, this is from the British Election Study, which looks at registration by ethnic group across the United Kingdom, you find registration varies quite substantially. 90% there for white British voters. In the 70% for Indian, Pakistani, Bangladesh and black Caribbean voters. You can see we're already here really in a mixture of ethnicity and nationality. And then black African voters, 59%. A lot of this, I'm told, will have to do with whether or not you live in private rented accommodation. The more you live in private rented accommodation, or if you live there, you're less likely to be registered to vote. And this reflects that to a significant degree. If the same academic study done by people at Essex and Manchester looking at vote choice by ethnic group in the 2010 general election, I realise this is not London, but of course a significant number of migrants and minority ethnic residents of the UK live in London, so this will tell us something about London. Very clear, if you remember, this result came out as Conservatives 36, Labour 29. If you look at the subcategories we've got here, in the 2010 general election, white British voters split slightly more Conservative Labour than the population as a whole. And then for most of the minority ethnic groups, slightly less for Indians, but more for Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, black Caribbeans and black Africans. By the time you get to Caribbeans and Africans, very large majority there Labour voting, relatively small, very small amount of Conservative voting. The only group that bucks the trend is white other. Now, white other will, of course, be an interesting combination, mingling as it does, I'm guessing, American bankers, well, it does, American bankers and new migrants from continental Europe, who themselves include very different kinds of white voters who are not British. So they are heavily pro-Conservative. Now, whether this tells us something, and I don't know this, this research doesn't show this yet, about the long-term propensities of migrants from continental Europe, including some of the poorer migrants from continental Europe, only time will tell. But anyway, this is relatively new research from the British Election Survey. What that same research shows is that age, education, social class are not strong predictors of turnout levels among minority voters, in the way that they are for white British, the white British population. So minority ethnic effects alone on voter choice are much greater than for class, housing, tenure or religion. Council house occupation is not associated with stronger Labour voting among minorities, that is, that the voting propensity is strong whether or not you live in social housing. And similarly, for small business owners, that's not the term used by the authors of this research, I think they call them petty bourgeois, the petty bourgeoisie is what they call them in the article, but I rewrote it for this, are not associated with stronger Conservative voting amongst minorities, so that doesn't work either. This is simply a statistical representation of that, and all it shows is that among ethnic minority respondents, as they call them in this study, whether you're manual or non-manual in terms of social and economic background, it's much less likely to affect your vote than if you are white in terms of this kind of research. Now, this research suggests that migration, or at least minority ethnic status, is likely to be associated with different registration levels and different voting patterns. White voters are more likely to vote and more likely to vote Conservative. Other white voters are significantly more likely to vote Conservative. Most other ethnic and national groups are less likely to vote, but more likely to vote Labour. Liberal Democrats, not to leave them out entirely, appear to do relatively well amongst Pakistani voters, according to this study of the last general election. Now, I just come back to this. This is just showing, and we can argue whether this is a precisely, that there should be a break, really, between 1991 and 2001, but it just shows you the drift of the change in the London population over a long period, from the 1960s all the way through to 2011. And if we now look at, now this is one of these things that does need a bit of deconstruction. What this is doing is saying, for each general election since 1955, what is the difference between the Great Britain voting percentage and the London voting percentage. Okay, so it's the difference between the percentage voting for each party in Britain as compared with London in every general election since 1955. If you look at the far end there, which was the days of the massive Conservative plus Labour domination of British politics, in fact, London, in terms of voting behaviour, apart from the Lib Dems to some extent, came closer to the Great Britain figures than any other region in the UK. Despite London being an odd place, its propensity to vote Conservative or Labour or Liberal Democrat was very little different from the Great Britain percentages in all those elections. But as you come this way, you find Labour starting to do better in the 70s, and then in the late Thatcher and Major years, the Conservatives doing somewhat better. Those two blue charts in 1987 and 92. But look at this end of the chart. So from 1997 onwards, the Labour Party overperforms in London, compares with its GB performance, and all the other parties underperform. Now, unhelpfully, of course, the big, big growth in most modern growth in international immigration to the UK started in about 1996. It cannot be that this effect is purely because of that, and I'm not sure we will know for a while exactly why this effect took place. It may have something to do with maybe a lagged impact of earlier migration, may have something to do with the post-1996-7 levels of migration. It may have something to do with Tony Blair and New Labour. I mean, it's too early to be sure about this yet, whether this is, you know, middle-class progressives feeling that they are safe to vote Labour with Tony Blair as leader, or I make it up. I don't know. Nobody knows. But certainly there is a shift here. And so the idea that London is a Labour city is a bit more true now than it was in the past. Still substantial Conservative voting, as we'll see in a moment. But it's now slightly more a pro-Labour city. Now, what I want to do is just quickly to look at, a bit like Antoine did for South London, there's a number of boroughs in more detail, and including Haringey, which I realise our previous chair once represented in Parliament. So you can see in Haringey, with the same kind of growth in migration that we've seen, in minority ethnic and now non-white British populations across the city as a whole. And here is the same kind of analysis that I did for London, just for Haringey. You can see very clearly, this is for London borough elections rather than general elections, that the Labour vote has been above the London trend all the way through this period, but the Conservative vote has declined. Now, as I'm about to show, it's hard to be certain that this has anything to do entirely, this is entirely to do with the changing population, the changing minority population of Haringey, but it may do. Croydon. Now here we've got a Conservative excess voting share. Even the last one is it will be higher than that because there was a general election on this last in 2010, which is created a slight benefit to the Labour Party and a disbenefit to the Conservatives by bringing out, compared with other local elections, what appears to be an invisible Labour vote, which comes out on general election day but not on local election days. So Conservatives still doing quite well in Croydon, but look at the Labour vote, which Labour used to be a long way behind in Croydon, and now they are catching up. And indeed, if you follow this trend and you easily trend that in, it looks as if, you know, you'd have to look at this and predict that it's going to be hard for the Conservatives to hold Croydon in the long term. The same is true in Redbridge. Sorry, can't move back easily. So here again, as in Croydon, Conservative vote above the London average remaining there, but look at the Labour figure, which is simply shifting over time. And again, it's hard to be certain this is because there's not been enough research done on this yet. I haven't done any detail to show that this is definitely as a result of the change in the minority population, but it may have something to do with it. Then there's Tower Hamlets. Now, no borough, and it's not strictly true, Tower Hamlets is one of the boroughs that's seen the most profound change in its population, from under 10% minority back in 1971 to approaching 70% non-white British now. But here, it's the Labour Party that's in decline, and the Conservatives who are doing better. So this is, of course, a different kind. Going back to what Ian was saying, this is the difference between non-white British voters who are rich and poor, we think. Because this, of course, is the product of a radical change in the makeup of Tower Hamlets. Tower Hamlets back in the late 60s used to have communists fighting in local elections. But now, the Labour Party is doing much less well than it once did, and as the population changes radically, the Conservatives are almost at the point where they perform as well in Tower Hamlets as they do across London, something that would have been absolutely inconceivable in the past. Now, I haven't done all the boroughs, because there are another 28 to go. I'm not doing them all, I'm doing one more. And that's Westminster. Now, Westminster has... You know, this is very similar as an increase to the one we saw in Tower Hamlets. But before anybody thinks, well, Westminster's only rich migrants, actually it isn't. If you look at the Westminster population, and I've tried to, taking the census, just break out, you know, of the 220,000 people in Westminster, rather more than half of them are non-UK born. And if you look at the non-UK born and break out, and I realise that Middle East and Asia may include affluent people from the Middle East, but aiming off for that. Look at the US and Canada, 44,000 out of the 116, sorry, US, Canada, and the old EU, so France, Germany and Italy and so on. So in Westminster, the increase in the non-white British population will substantially have been amongst this group in the middle over time. And here the Conservatives have done much, much better latterly. There's been a shift to the Conservatives over time in here, as there has been in Tower Hamlets. And there are other boroughs of which this is true as well. So I'm simply making the point here that whilst it is certainly what the academic studies suggest is that minority voters, and certainly from what would have been previously considered the new Commonwealth type minority voters, undoubtedly are much more likely, if they're registered to vote Labour. Then if you look at the wider picture across London, it's definitely not that simple, that from borough to borough you have very different effects, and certainly amongst some of the minority groups, Indians in particular, some evidence that over time they are shifting away from only voting Labour. So you've got other effects going on as well. So to conclude, the first thing, and I should have said this earlier, of course, is that the Conservatives and Labour are in long-term decline in London as they are throughout the country. The London electorate, in common with many other aspects of the city, have, of course, been affected by migration. There's some national evidence which I've shown about the effects of minority ethnic status on voting, and within London there must have been an impact which overall is more likely to have helped Labour than the Conservatives and even the Lib Dems, certainly the Lib Dems thus far. And minorities are less likely than the white British population to register to vote, which to some extent counters the Labour advantage. New migrant groups appear to have different voting propensities from existing residents. There are very different underlying patterns of voting change from borough to borough. In some places you've got, with lots of a radically changed population and a more minority population now than in the past, quite substantial shifts from the Conservatives to Labour, other from Labour to the Conservatives, Tower Hamlets, others from Labour to the Liberal Democrats, and others still from the Liberal Democrats to Labour. And going back to what Antoine was saying earlier, something strikes me about all of this is again and again and again how the fragmentation of London's government can never be totally... You can always see that as a part of an explanation about what's going on in London. In terms of everything, tall buildings, the way where immigrants go to live, everything is at some level influenced by the highly fragmented system of government. Any short-term impacts of migration may weaken as minority groups establish themselves over time. There is some evidence that this is happening, not amongst all minority groups, but amongst some. And of course, there is some evidence that some of the newer migrant groups may not be as willing to vote Labour as some of the previous ones. But we don't have enough evidence about that yet. And lastly, and not a point, I just added this as a final point on the last slide because I'd forgotten to put it in before. There is some evidence that, I mean, where you get extremist voting for new, relatively nationalist or extremist parties, this does happen from time to time in London, but it occurs where the migrants are new to the borough. So if you look at where the National Front did well in the 1970s, it was in places like Hackney and Newham, where they, you know, where their successors wouldn't really try, certainly not with any expectation. Of course, in 2006, it was in Barking and Dagenham, where there'd been a very, very large uptick in new migration in the previous decade, where the BNP, the British National Party, did well, but there too, they may now be in decline. Once a minority population has been established over time, then the impact on extremist voting dies away, suggesting that this is all a matter of what is new, not a matter of underlying attitude. But that is a brief canter through the impact of migration minority status on voting in London over time. Work in progress. Thank you very much.
Max Nathan, over to you. Migration and innovation.
Right, so as the title suggests, this is going to be about connections between migration, diversities, and innovation. There's quite a lot to talk about, and I haven't got too much time, so I'm going to run through these four elements fairly quickly. A little bit of context, what I hope will be a simple framework, a flavour of the evidence, such as it is, some high-level policy messages which we can take away from this. Two sort of caveats. I mean, this is shifting the discussion a bit from demography and sort of household space and political space into economic spaces, and there's also going to be a bit of a language shift, so some of what I say will be quite economistic and perhaps a bit jargony, but I will try and keep that to a minimum, and there will be no equations. So, a little bit of context to start with. Two things stand out from these numbers, which come from some work that the UN and the OECD did last year. The first is the fact that the global quantum of migrants is high and rising. I mean, most of us know that, I think. The thing that surprised me is this second figure, the shift in the skilled migrant share. So, in this data, they're talking about people who have a degree. When I talk about skilled migrants and skilled people in the context of diversity, I also want to talk about people with particular domain knowledge and experience, which might go over and above qualifications. And you'll see in a moment why that is important. The other thing, I guess, is that this skilled migrant share is, depending on how you want to look at it, it looks fairly high to me. It's also rising. So, if you come back in another 10 years, we'll be, over 30%, I'd expect. So that has quite important consequences for researchers in terms of what we think migrants might be doing when they get to country X or country Y, and links back to countries where they've come from. But also you can start to see there are potentially important implications for migration policy. And policymakers in the UK and other countries are only just starting to sort of get hold of this. Now that skill component in the UK context is a little different. So if you look at the sort of human capital component of UK migrants, it's about the same as people who were born in the UK. So that third number is going to be higher in the UK sense. That's one important thing about the UK context. The other important thing is the way that net migration and natural change in moving together. So if you think back to Eric's presentation earlier, quite a lot of what he shows in London is also true at the national level, and I think he was making that connection in his slides. So you can see the UK is basically a country of fairly low net migration until about the mid-90s, and net births are driving population change. And then you have this sort of series of increases in net migration, and natural change starts moving along with that as well. And that's partly to do with continued population growth in people who were born in the UK, but it also reflects migrants who are settling, population composition changes, and different birth rates in migration groups. So increasingly, this is kind of all of us who are driving this rather than just migrants who are driving this. And you can see that very clearly if you look at London. This is a map which I've taken from one of Susie's papers, and like in a childlike way, drawn a kind of red line on it to illustrate the point. So this is Woolworth Road in South London, and what Susie has done, and this is, you know, data gathered by hand, is to link back the birth countries or the ethnicities of the shop owners on the street to different places around the world. So when people talk about super diversity, this is a really good example of what we mean. And there are a number of different diversities bundled up in here. So we have birth country, we have ethnicity, there is religion and language, and there are a number of facets to that captured in here. And those don't always reflect very clearly in the conversation. In particular, you know, economists and economic models tend to bundle a lot of those diversities up. So I'm going to do a bit of abstraction here. The two points I want you to take away from this slide are firstly that until fairly recently, economists and economic analysis has tended to think about the labour market impacts of migration and the diversity that migration helps to generate. And that is a sort of static and quite limiting framework. We are starting to move towards a point where we are thinking about migration and diversity in the context of growth and growth models. And you can see some of the sort of founding assumptions in the bullet points down there. And that allows, you know, in the jargon, it sort of allows migrants to do a whole bunch of other things, and it also allows us to think about a whole set of different effects on the production side and the consumption side. And this is, you know, this is a fairly new field, but there are a growing number of people working in this area. In fact, I can see one of them at the back there, Stephen Syrett from Middlesex, who has done a lot of work on this. So there are a number of places where we might look within firms in different types of market space and also on the consumption side of the economy. I want to concentrate on the first two of these. So when we think about innovation, I'm going to use this fairly standard definition of innovation as the generation and exploitation of new ideas. This is a very noisy process. It's very easy to have a lot of ideas. It's much harder to have good ideas, and it's even harder to have ideas which can be taken from inside your head into something that can actually go out into the world and stand up. So when people in the field talk about innovation, they have this notion of going from the upstream to the downstream. So I think this is helpful because it allows us to see a number of points in which demographic change might enter into processes of innovation. And here are some of them. So again, this is a little bit jargony, but people who are who have expertise or high human capital or some other form of skill may positively select into migration. And there are programs in the UK and elsewhere that try and pull these people in. There are some interesting studies looking at the effects of more culturally or ethnically diverse teams. And the idea here is that if you have a bigger pool of ideas, that might help quantity and quality of ideas generation. Diasporic communities might help ideas to flow internationally. At market level, migrant entrepreneurship helps bring ideas into the market, but it also might force a reaction from incumbent firms. I mean, that's a process with winners and losers, and that's something that we don't understand enough about at the moment. Big cities like London, which are good for innovation, could amplify all of this stuff. But there are important constraints to look at. So in theory, all of those positive channels could be washed away by other stuff going on, potentially negative effects of diversity in the workplace, or discrimination out in society. The evidence we've got is still relatively sparse. There's not nearly as much of this as we'd like, and certainly not as much as policymakers would like, I think. The sort of biggest cluster of studies we have is from the US, and as you can see here, that shows fairly clear links from skilled migrants and diasporas to innovation and increased trade, especially in tech sectors and especially in communities of South Asian or Southeast Asian origin. So think about Silicon Valley and the South Bay as the classic example of that. The European evidence, such as it is a little bit more mixed. It tends to focus on the sort of firms channel, but does, you know, quite often find small but robust benefits of having diverse teams around. I mentioned the Bay Area before. There are some good city-level evidence, both quantitative and qualitative, suggesting urban spillovers are going on.
What does that mean?
Spillovers. Yeah. I'll explain it in a second. So this is some of what we have for London. So there's a large set of sort of qualitative and case study evidence, which I will come back to in a second, but I wanted to show you this because this is one of the few studies that tries to put some numbers on it. So this is some work that I did with Neil Lee, a colleague at LSE. This was the best data that we could easily get, and it's a sort of cross-sectional analysis of firms. What it's showing you here is small but robust positive links from the diversity of the workforce or the diversity of the senior management to the amount of innovation that these firms do. However, we don't find any robust association to revenue growth, and there are a number of reasons why that might be the case. We found this operating across all sectors of the London economy, not just the knowledge economy, which was interesting and surprising to us. The migrant diverse firms, by which I mean sort of diversity in terms of country of birth, these firms were more export orientated. We found a small positive association, but nothing causal, between migrant status and proactive entrepreneurship, by which I mean people answering the survey saying, I founded this firm because I spotted a gap in the market, or it was what I wanted to do. But as the qualitative evidence makes clear, there are a number of other factors in the mix here. So we should be careful, I think, about ascribing all of this purely to migrant status or to ethnicity or whatever aspect of diversity you're interested in. There'll be other stuff here running alongside it, and we control for as much of that as we can. So what are the policy implications of this? I mean, there are two sets of things, really. You can see from the theory and from the evidence that we have, there are reasons to expect migration, particularly skilled migration, to have net positive effects on innovation in the UK, and there are good reasons to think that some of those might be amplified in London. It is less obvious, I think, how to design policy to maximise the positives and minimise the negatives. This is partly because we don't have much research, and it's partly because there isn't much policy around. So policymakers are essentially in an experimental phase of doing this, and I think it's important that we realise this. It's also quite difficult to design high-quality impact evaluation because it's difficult to build a counterfactual. I mean, you're sort of either here or you're not here. And so there are a number of quite big questions, such as these two here, which we still don't have answers to and which are important for designing effective policy. I think one big question for policymakers is whether we want highly targeted programmes like the sort of tier one element of the points-based system in the UK or start-up visas in countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, that's sort of still being debated in the US. Or do you rely on the sense that this is basically a noisy process? You have lots of ideas. So if you let a lot of people in and just roll the dice, that might turn out to be a more effective way of generating these innovation effects if they exist, rather than trying to pick your winners beforehand. And certainly in the UK case, tier one inflows are very small compared with the number of people coming through basically unregulated migration channels. Certainly it's important to sort of experiment and flex some of these targeted schemes. So this feels quite a lot like industrial policy, I think. And there are certainly things that can be learned from joining that up with the mainstream of immigration policy. whether London should have its own migration policy is a sort of an issue I want to just end on quickly. I mean, this is an interesting idea. There aren't many countries in the world that do this. Canada has this federated system where Quebec has its own migration policy. That's quite problematic because people don't always want to stay in Quebec. I think it would, even though Montreal is very nice, I think in London's case that problem would be less of an issue since London has such a massive sort of gravitational pull in the UK economy. Certainly from a research point of view it would be interesting to try some of this stuff out, but it would make policy quite a lot more complex. There would be a risk of competition between London and the UK levels of government, and I think it would be hard to give this just to London and not to give this to other big cities in the UK system. And that's it. Thanks.
Do you have a particular sort of technical questions for Max? I mean, I want to sort of say general questions for the later session, but are there any questions of a sort of fairly technical kind? No, okay, I'm going to hand over to Sarah from CBI, London Regional Director.
Thank you. I haven't got any slides, so I'm just going to talk and give some general thoughts. And I think, Max, you actually set me up really nicely with your end of your presentation talking about policy, because I don't know, do you all know what CBI is and what we do and who we are? Shake your head if you don't know. Okay. So I've got a few shakes of heads, so I'll explain. We are a business lobbying organisation, so we exist in order to represent the needs of businesses to the government, primarily in the UK. That's our heritage in the UK, but increasingly internationally as well. So I spend my time working with companies operating in London, but also we're a national organisation, so across the UK, working out what they need from policymakers in order to be successful, employ people, grow and create wealth and jobs in the UK. So policy is a lot of what we spend our time doing, which is why the end of Max's presentation segued so neatly into what I want to say. So I've been asked to talk about the business view of immigration and the impact on business and the implications for business. I think, firstly, that's entirely relevant because business is one of the loudest voices in the migration debate. But I just want to start by being clear that we don't see business as somehow being a unique and separate voice from the rest of what society says about immigration. Businesses are really an integral part of society, and so lots of the things that business says that it wants and needs are very much reflected in the voice of other stakeholders as well. And the overall message that we hear from businesses across the UK is that they want a managed and balanced migration system that on the one hand allows them to access the skills and talents that they need. Also that applies to universities, to getting international students and attracting international visitors, particularly in the tourist industry, to the UK. But that also balances that with the social pressures that migration can cause, whether that be on infrastructure or on things like school places, hospital places. So the need for a balanced migration system is something that business says that it wants very clearly. From a business point of view, there are really two reasons why they want a migration system that allows people to go both in and out of the UK. The out is important too. The first one is to address short-term skills challenges in the economy. We hear an awful lot of concern from a lot of companies about a lack of availability of skilled workers. There are some really classic industries where this is a perennial problem at the moment. Engineering is one. In London, particularly the tech sector is another one. We hear it in pharma and bioscience. But also we have fluctuations in sectors all the time. So at the moment, we have a particular problem in construction, where a lot of people left the construction industry during the downturn 2008. The industry is picking back up, but we don't necessarily have the people in the sector who can immediately fill those jobs. So if you're a bricklayer, for example, at the moment, you can pretty much command your salary. There's a real shortage of bricklayers in the UK. So lots of companies want to be able to bring in people to address those short-term skills fluctuations. Now, clearly that's not a long-term sustainable solution, and certainly nobody likes a situation where we have a million young unemployed people in the UK and Rolls-Royce and Derby can't find enough trained graduate engineers. That's not a situation that people want perpetuated, so there's a long-term aim to equip young people in Britain with the skills to get those jobs. But in the short term, a migration system can help you balance some of those fluctuations in demand. Secondly, then, in a global economy, we want to be the country that firms who started their life in the UK then can go out and compete and do business on an international stage. For that, they'll need international workers based in their firms. We also want to be the kind of country that attracts international firms domiciled in other countries to have a presence here in the UK, and they want to be able to move people around flexibly. So that's a really important reason for allowing a balanced migration system. I think people often think about that in terms of bringing people into the UK, but there's actually a big export story here. When we did, we do a London business survey asking businesses in London what they think, and when we did the survey in December, so December 2013, 39% of respondents to the survey said that their top priority for boosting exports to priority markets was an improved visa and immigration system in the UK. So in order to boost exports, their top priority was an improvement in immigration. So that just says something about how important it is for businesses wanting to do business internationally. Max has also given us some food for thought about a third possible reason for wanting more migration, which is around the role that it can play in innovation as well. So that's why business calls for a balanced migration system. That's what it wants. I thought I would spend a bit of time talking about how we think current policy stacks up against that, because that's been the subject of an awful lot of heat, some light, but not as much light as we might have liked over the past few years. And really, in any immigration system, we are looking for three Ps. So the three Ps of migration systems for us are policy, performance, and perception. So I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about what business thinks, or how business thinks the UK is doing on each of these fronts. So on policy, just to start with, this is the area that's got perhaps the most airtime in recent years, and we can understand why. That's largely because ahead of the 2010 general election, the Conservatives wrote in their election manifesto a commitment to get net migration down into the tens of thousands by the 2015 general election. So that's somewhere under 100,000. That's extremely challenging as a target for several reasons, not least because it's a net migration target. So clearly that also is impacted by the number of people leaving. And unless you choose to have an explicit policy to make life in the UK so unbearable that we all choose to leave, which isn't the policy of any government that I know, unless that's your explicit policy, it's very difficult to control who is leaving the UK. But also, as we know, the immigration into the UK is hugely impacted by levels of EU migration, which, while we're a member of the European Union, and we know there are political parties who have views on that, but in the life of this Parliament, that's not going to change. So it's extremely difficult to control that. And those factors make the target that the Conservative Party set itself look increasingly unachievable. In fact, data published at the beginning of this month, you may have already referenced this in your conference, showed that net migration had actually increased in the year to September 2013 to 212,000, which is up from, I think, 154,000 the year before. So a statistically significant increase in net migration, which just shows how challenging that target is. And when we think about the types of migration that CBI members talk about all the time, they're talking about particularly Tier 1 and 2 migration, and then also in Tier 4 for students. But if we look at what happened in those figures up until the end of 2013 for that increase in migration, actually only just under 10,000 of those were accounted for by work visas, so 9,750 was an increase in work visas, and study visas was just over 9,000. A much bigger amount, 40,000, was accounted for by an increase in EU immigration, which is that factor that we are unable to control with current policy. Nonetheless, when the Conservatives formed the coalition government, they set about trying to implement their policy, and that caused some significant worries for the business community in the way they went around that, particularly they imposed an interim cap. The design and the implementation of that cap was chaotic and was extremely unworkable and damaging for many businesses who just couldn't get the numbers of visas they wanted. You had companies like I'm not going to name them, but big multinationals who could get something like 15 visas a year, which is crazy when they have workforces of tens of thousands of people. So it was extremely worrying and did a lot of damage to the perception of the UK as a place. We use the phrase open for business. That did a lot of damage. However, since then, the actual permanent implementation of the policy took on board a lot of those concerns and actually went a significant way to meeting some of them. We lobbied and got things like a removal of ICT's intra-company transfers were removed from the cap, which was really important for us. There was no limit on students in Tier 4, which was something that we lobbied for alongside others. And the government committed to not constantly tinkering with the numbers of the visas allowed under Tier 2, just to try and give business a bit more certainty and stability. So a lot of the worst outcomes that we feared when we saw the interim cap were actually avoided in the design of the permanent cap. That's not to say we don't have any issues with the way the current policy is operating. We do. There are some, for example, the regional pay banding is causing a problem for us. So the minimum thresholds for graduate salaries under this scheme mean that essentially people have to be employed south of Birmingham. And we speak to technology companies in the northeast who say they just simply can't. They can't employ graduates under visas because they would have to pay them disproportionate salaries compared to the rest of their workforce, and it creates too much distortion for them. The cooling off period, where individuals used to be able to localise under Tier 2 visas, that's causing some concern, and we're likely to see the full impact of that in 2016 when the final 5-year periods that were granted in 2011 run out. Tier 4 switching into Tier 2, something that LSE in particular will have experienced, and this is where you can, if you come in under a Tier 4 visa and you get a job, you can stay and work for an employer, but now you have to have your qualification awarded before you can switch. That causes a problem for lots of graduate recruiters who start their programmes when education courses end and then there's a period of transition, and we're simply saying allow the students to transfer onto a Tier 2 visa when they've completed their educational requirements rather than when they're actually physically granted their degree. And then things around advertising and Job Centre Plus continues to be really bureaucratic, and we question how valid it is anyway when you have the increased skills requirements and the increased salary thresholds that are being imposed. So we have some concerns about how it operates, but it is less damaging than the initial interim cap first appeared. But we still hear an awful lot of concern from people about the immigration system, concern from our members. So what's going on? Well, that leads me to my second P, which is performance of the system. And this is a sort of softer side of policy. So this is how it's actually being implemented on the ground. And the performance of the system has a critical impact on business perception of the immigration system. And I think it's fair to say that poor service levels have severely undermined the business view of the system and actually done a lot of damage to some of the good work that we've done on the specific design of the individual policy. This is particularly galling for businesses and for universities as well, because since 2008, employers and sponsoring organisations have actually taken on a lot of the cost and the administration of the system and are matched with inflation, pay increases in the system above inflation each year, and deteriorating service levels. So despite doing more work yourselves and paying more, the service levels are getting worse, which is not a situation that people want to be in. The standards of service in 2012 and early 2013 were particularly poor. We saw lots of examples you'll have seen in the press about queues at immigration, particularly at Heathrow, which were worrying people, and long processing times for documentation. The UKBA has now been restructured into UKVI, but the long shadow that was cast by those poor service levels continue to be felt. And we did a survey, employment trend survey, at the end of last year, and we asked businesses across the UK what they thought, and 3/4 of firms said that they thought the service levels had stayed the same, 20% said they had deteriorated, and only 5% said that they had seen an improvement. So 95% of firms thought that the service levels were still either the same or getting worse, despite this restructuring, which is not an encouraging finding. Of those who said it was getting worse, 75% said that was in customer service, 53% said it was document turnaround time, and 16% were complaining about appointment availability. So improving service levels is a real priority for us, particularly for small and medium-sized businesses and universities who don't have access to advisors and students, for example, who aren't used to navigating the system. And we've got a number of suggestions around things like how you can improve documentation, processing, and just improving the communication between UKVI and the applicants. There's a lot of very small, either missing bits of documentation, factual errors or inaccuracies that could be cleared up very simply with better communication that simply aren't being at the moment. And if you take a combination then of the change to the policy implemented since the coalition government formed and those poor service levels, that leads to my third P, which is perception. And this is possibly the area where actually the current government has most work to do with the business community and with other users like universities of the system. Again, in our employment trends survey, in 2012 this was, a third of respondents said that they thought that the introduction of a permanent cap on Tier 2 damaged the UK's perception as a place to do business. So just the very fact of introducing a cap they felt was damaging. And recently big employers, I've got a quote from Tata Consultancy Services, their CEO said that their investments in the UK were being damaged by the UK's approach to immigration policy. So whilst we have done a lot of work on specific design and service delivery levels under the current system, the sort of political rhetoric about it is concerning and is sending a message that the UK isn't open for business. If you're a family in India who's thinking about sending your son or daughter to a university in the UK, would you know from what you read in the press that there's no limit on the number of students who are able to come to the UK? I suggest that that wouldn't be the perception that you form from the rhetoric around the immigration system, and this is really concerning. And it's probably the heartening finale to this is that it's probably going to get worse as well in the next few years as we head towards the 2015 general election. We know that we've got UKIP becoming an increasingly vocal force in British politics, expected to do extremely well in the European elections in just 6 weeks' time. Nigel Farage has a quote here saying there's an awful lot of people being hurt in London by uncontrolled mass immigration, and so very clearly a concern from UKIP about immigration levels to the UK, and a clear statement about what they would do to our membership of the European Union in order to address what I described at the beginning as some of the aspects of immigration that's less easy for us to control. What will be interesting to see after the European elections in 6 weeks' time is how the traditional incumbent UK parties, particularly Conservatives and the Labour Party, respond to that, and whether we see any shift in policy to try and steal some of that vote back. That will all lead up to the 2015 general election. Before we get there, we have a Scottish referendum. So immigration levels in the UK might be boosted by a new international country joining our immigration system. We don't know. We will see. And then, depending on the outcome of the 2015 general election, if the Conservatives form majority government, they have promised a referendum on our membership of the European Union in 2017. Which obviously would then affect, again, the UK's approach to immigration if they did indeed hold that referendum and if the British public voted to leave the European Union. CBI doesn't believe that should happen. I'm not going to enter into the debate about Europe. That's a whole other seminar topic, which I'm not going to go into. But we believe very much that we should be a global trading nation. We think we should be open to international business in the UK. And we think that making sure that we have an immigration system and a place in Europe that allows for that to happen is a critical part of the global future that we should be trying to forge for the UK. So those are a few thoughts from me on what business thinks about immigration.